Hello, my name is Chris Snipes, and you are listening to The Melt.
As a reminder, my notion and my book of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is that the innovations we are seeing today in terms of artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, cloud computing, advanced robotics, and many others together constitute a new phase in human development, on par or even exceeding previous industrial revolutions in scale and impact. COVID-19, if anything, has accelerated this ongoing industrial revolution. If COVID had happened even 10 years ago, we could not have imagined moving entire companies, schools, and government offices so fast online. Today, that is a reality. The fourth industrial revolution has become a reality, not just for the pioneers, but for a broad range of people and workers. We are also seeing macroeconomic consequences, changes. Big tech companies such as Apple, Samsung, Alphabet, Amazon, or Facebook already are among the largest global companies, but the last months have further cemented their leading positions in the market, while others have started to lag further behind. That will prove to be not only the case now, but will be a permanent consequence of COVID-19. But these past few months have also shown that the fourth industrial revolution will not be beneficial to all unless we make conscious choices and investments to ensure that this is the case. Disadvantaged school students, unskilled workers, and non-digitized companies and governments will feel the crisis much more than others. Moreover, both corporate and income inequality have worsened during the last months. So when we build the post-COVID world, when we do the Great Reset, one of the most important places to start will be to ensure that the fruits of the fourth industrial revolution are really shared by all. It starts with equitable investments, particularly in education and reskilling. And it also implies we come up with a new framework to regulate data ownership, intellectual property, and competition in the fourth industrial revolution. This requires public-private cooperation. So, to the participants of this World Knowledge Forum, my message is this. It is very important to embrace the fourth industrial revolution and its technology, as it will determine our future prosperity, like nothing else.
Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!
I can't think of a better spokesman for something as sinister as the Great Reset than the founder of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab. He lacks the prerequisite warmth to be able to sell such a dystopian hell to the entire Earth, but I sometimes wonder if it matters. It seems that many people actually believe that the Great Reset is just some concoction of basement-dwelling conspiracy theorists, and the rest of those who have even heard of it just cherry-pick the buzzwords that they want to hear when they have it explained to them that allow them to interpret it as something remotely resembling a good idea. What I think that many included in this last group don't grasp is that this is merely window dressing for the butcher shop. What is really being rolled out and verbally skirted around is that what is being talked about is nothing short of a totalitarian technocracy which will be enforced by a surveillance state of the likes of which is only intimated in the most dystopic of sci-fi literature. With a combo of biometrics, control of the food supply, and a cashless society, we will potentially be robbed of our autonomy willingly in exchange for safety, security, and convenience. Is this inevitable? Well, nothing is inevitable. Shining a light on what is afoot is the first step, followed by action. To give us a primer on this Great Reset, I have asked James Corbett of the Corbett Report on the show to break it down for us and let us know what are some steps we can take to maintain our autonomy. I start off the conversation by asking James to give us a summary of what the Great Reset is.
So the Great Reset is something that has been launched by the World Economic Forum, which is something, an organization that people may or may not know about, given that it is the organization that hosts the annual Davos conference. And I'm sure we've all heard of Davos every January. All this global jet set of business leaders and important figures gather in Davos, Switzerland, to hold a little talking shop for a week or two. And a lot of pronouncements are made, and there's a lot of news coverage about it. But that's generally all the public has ever heard about the World Economic Forum in the past. But that has changed over the course of the past year, as the World Economic Forum has released something called the Great Reset, which is their vision. And this vision is seemingly coming from the very top of the World Economic Forum, namely the chairman, Klaus Schwab, a vision for what they are calling a reset of society. And how far does that extend? What does that actually entail? Well, I'm not sure there is really a limit to this vision, because they are talking about not only, obviously, a reset in terms of the way that we are handling the economic fallout from the worldwide shutdown of the economy that we've seen over the past year, but more broadly even than that, a reset of the way imagining of doing business and what does that mean in a post-pandemic era, and even talking about rewriting the social contract, which is something that's been talked about quite explicitly by the World Economic Forum and the various people associated with this project, including luminaries like Prince Charles and John Kerry and the head of the IMF. They've had many, many speakers talking at their various talking shops about the Great Reset. And I would love to be able to say in a nutshell what it is, but I really don't think they've put a limit on what this is. It's simply a sort of carte blanche for the would-be rulers of the world, essentially, to tell the rest of the world how to live their lives and how things are going to change now that they've hit the Great Reset button because of the COVID whatever scare of 2020.
Exactly. It's an octopus with many tentacles, to be sure. So how was COVID sort of the setup for this? How did this, I mean, it seemed, obviously it's very choreographed, but the timing of the whole COVID malarkey that's going on right now and how easy it was to get people to jump through the hoops that they were setting up for them. How is this helping to usher in this Great Reset at this particular juncture?
Well, I will note parenthetically because it's certainly circumstantial evidence, but it is important to note that the World Economic Forum was a co-host of the Event 201 pandemic exercise that was held in October of 2019 that was imagining what would happen in the event of a globally spreading coronavirus pandemic. So I find that interesting. But at any rate, the World Economic Forum has jumped all over what has actually unfolded during this crisis that they so interestingly predicted the year before by specifically harnessing, I think, the economic and business disruption that has obviously has occurred as a result of this, as companies either close and or send workers home, and we have to start to reimagine what business looks like in this era where everything is increasingly becoming digital and online. And I think that is one of the keys of what this Great Reset is really about, is the moving online of things that previously we couldn't have imagined having been online. Everything had to be done in person. People had to go to physical work offices and partake in face-to-face meetings. Well, increasingly, well, that's not going to happen. Now we've got Zoom and all of these other things that are ways for people to interact without ever having to meet each other face-to-face. Now, there are obviously all sorts of ramifications for that, but one that I think should be interesting, at least to us here in the post-Snowden era, let alone all of the other NSA whistleblowers that preceded Snowden and got 0% of the attention that he did. But at any rate, in the post-Snowden era, we know that the online world is completely and utterly surveilled by, at the very least, the NSA and its brethren in the GCHQ and associated intelligence apparatuses around the world. So we know that as business and as more of our lives go online, they will ultimately end up being surveilled and put into the vast databases, such as the database that was created by the NSA at Salt Lake Springs in Utah in the past few years to basically harvest and collect as much data as possible from as many people as possible. It would be quite naive to think that that isn't one of the factors that goes into something like the moving of our entire lives into the online space. Now they are not only observable and surveillable and databaseable from a distance, but also, as we are increasingly seeing, censorable. Because of course, as people may or may not know, I myself have had my work heavily censored over the course of the past year, culminating in the deletion of my main YouTube channel just in the past week or two here as we record this. And that was on top of a banning from Patreon in the month before that. And of course, I'm not alone in this. I'm just one of many, 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 many independent news sources that are finding themselves increasingly deplatformed, banned, censored, algorithmically obscured, and otherwise brushed to the margins as everyone's going online, but not to find that information, let me tell you. So that's one of the ramifications of this, is that what is taking place is a consolidation of information control over the increasing digitalization of our lives. Now, that is bad enough. But unfortunately, the plan does get even creepier and even more controlling as it starts to unfold from here, as we are starting to see, and as people like myself have been warning about for, well, since this entire crisis kicked off last year, but as we are starting to see playing out in the mainstream news headlines now, we are starting to see the debates over vaccine passports and when and how should people be allowed to go back into the social space, and what sorts of restrictions should be put on that, and should people only be allowed into certain events if they've been vaccinated, etc. And if so, well, then how do we coordinate that? We can't just have these slips of paper. Well, we're going to have to obviously create some sort of digital identity, and we'll have to make some sort of app that will be able to store that digital identity and store it with your test results and your vaccination certificates. And maybe there might be a space for the government to step in and sort of coordinate these efforts so that they're not all mishmash. And one could very easily see how this very quickly becomes essentially a biometric ID that is tied into not only your health records, but eventually into some form of social credit score, where if you're like me, someone who is talking about the wrong things online, well, you're not going to be able to have an online account, or you're not going to be able to be approved for access to this space. Things that really would have sounded, I think, outlandish to the average person just a year ago are starting to sound like sensible common sense. We can't have these dangerous anti-vaxxers, or whatever term they're going to throw around next week for people that they dislike, participating in public space, in public life. And increasingly, we're seeing governments taking unto themselves the power to actually force people out of the public sphere. As, for example, just in the past few days, Ontario in Canada has increasingly announced not only that people need a valid reason to be outside of their house and can be stopped by police for simply being outside of their house to demand a reason for why they are actually outside of their house, but also they're shutting down the borders now, and people need a reason to come or go from the province itself. I mean, we are seeing the enacting of police states right now that, again, would have been unthinkable in other circumstances, and yet are being actively cheered on by a significant percentage of the public right now, as we are stepping towards this completely surveilled, completely controlled society.
Yeah, and I think that the only, well, one of the ways that that can occur is to sort of install an inner police state within everybody. Because before that point, you know, people were always calling each other out, publicly shaming others for not wearing masks, for questioning the narrative. And so it seems just sort of a graceful priming to finally get to the point where, okay, well, if you're not going to listen to me, then the state will step in and I will gladly applaud that because they have made themselves out to be the puffy-chested keepers of civility and, you know, by being the mask wearers and the heroes to, okay, well, if you're not going to buy that, we're going to conveniently label anybody who even not only questions the narrative, but, you know, questions where all this is leading us as a conspiracy theorist. And I'm sure you're well aware of that term and have been put under that umbrella for a long time.
Exactly right. And I couldn't agree more with what you're saying here and what you're gesturing towards. It's something that I wrote about in a provocatively titled editorial last November, How to Save the World in One Easy Step, where I make the point that the most powerful weapon ever invented isn't the mother of all bombs or the H-bomb or the A-bomb or rods from God or Chinese microwave weapons or anything else of that sort. No, the most powerful weapon that has ever been deployed on the human population is narrative. Is essentially creating a story that is captivating enough to capture people's minds and motivate them to act in a certain way. And that is obviously, self-evidently, what we are seeing happening right now, where a large portion of the public is not only clamoring to become the lab rats, essentially, in long-term clinical tests that are ongoing right now for experimental gene therapies that are being marketed to the public as vaccines, but that people who do not go along with that, who have any sense that perhaps we should be cautious about the deploying of this brand new medical intervention on a mass, completely worldwide scale, perhaps we should be a little bit cautious with this, or at the very least, perhaps I should have the right to say no to that medical intervention on my body. Those people are being cast out of public life and being thoroughly ridiculed for that personal medical decision against something that might have been, if not unthinkable, at least not, certainly never before in my lifetime has this sort of issue taken this stage in the general public discourse. And that has been, I think, a process of leading people through a path. First, it's listen to the health authorities 2 weeks to flatten the curve. And then it goes from don't wear a mask to wear a mask and then to wear two masks. And I think that was preparatory towards the stage of saying, well, now the experts are saying we must accept this medical intervention. And you can't think for yourself on this issue. You must simply listen to what you're being told. And unfortunately, that really is a powerful, powerful weapon on so many people who don't really have the mental faculties to be able to defend themselves from that weapon of narrative.
Exactly. And well, something I found interesting, too, that I came across when I was listening to some of your podcasts is you make the connection between the tech that was developed for 9/11 and how that same tech is being used for the COVID situation too. What are some of the similarities between the dynamics of those two situations?
Well, I think they both rely on a similar underlying premise, essentially that there's this, if not completely invisible in the case of terrorists, at least unknowable enemy that's sort of vaguely amorphously out there. And we can't necessarily just immediately identify who is or is not a terrorist. Well, that idea, of course, necessitated the rise of all sorts of various screening technology, quite literally in the case, of course, of the airports. And eventually, after a series of provocations, of course, the release of the naked air X-ray airport body scanners that have become par for the course over the past several years, that, again, would have sounded like sci-fi far out technology just a couple of decades ago. But also in of course, the Patriot Act and all the various sorts of legislation and other things that have come along to combat this vague amorphous threat that could be anywhere out there and anyone could be a terrorist, so we have to screen everyone. Well, of course, that has mapped on quite nicely to the new paradigm, which is quite literally this invisible enemy of this virus that you may or may not be an asymptomatic carrier of, and you can't know unless you go in for this test, which, oh, by the way, often gives false positive results, but don't worry about that. You need this test to tell you whether or not you have this virus. And if it comes back positive, then you have to quarantine yourself in your home. If you go out, we will fine you $10,000 or we'll throw you in jail or whatever. We have to shut down businesses and or church services and or anything else that we say that could potentially cause any sort of threat to the public health for any reason at any time at all under any restrictions that we want. And anyone who disagrees with this is an enemy that must be dealt with in the same way anyone who questioned the terrorist narrative of the first couple of decades of this century. Well, you sound like a terrorist yourself. Perhaps you're under suspicion now. If anything, it's actually just an amplification of that old terrorist paradigm where anyone could potentially be a threat, so we have to guard against it at all times. Well, now, not only, I mean, in the old terrorist paradigm, at least the terrorist presumably knows that they are a terrorist, even if they don't have any outward signs of it. Well, in this case, you don't know at all. You may be an asymptomatic carrier, and you have no way of knowing until this test tells you whether you are or not. So it has nothing to do with any intention or any mental intention or anything that you want to do in the world. It's just a thing that exists, and we have this test for you, and it will tell you whether or not you are allowed to access human society. It's quite nightmarish, but quite it would be difficult to think of a more effective way of controlling billions of people and controlling their actions and their ability to even interact with each other.
Exactly. Yeah, it's ingenious. I have to applaud them. But man, the masses are falling for it hook, line, and sinker. So what is another aspect of this is biometric monitoring. What is that, and how is it the ultimate invasion of privacy?
Well, biometrics are essentially, they were really first developed, or at least in the modern scientific form, by Francis Galton, who got an interest in fingerprints and fingerprinting as part of his general interest in a number of different areas. But he also wrapped it into his eugenics philosophy, which he was developing at that time, that there is genes. They didn't, of course, have the scientific terminology or understanding of genes at that time, but protoplasm, or whatever they referred to it at that time, that was good stock that needed to be propagated. And of course, well, the rich and powerful people have the good stock, and these poor people who are breeding like vermin need to be eliminated from the gene pool, essentially, was the upshot of the eugenics philosophy. And so biometrics was one of the ways that we can measure and test, not just looking at people's fingerprints, and which ultimately got adopted, of course, by police forces and used as a type of forensics for identifying criminals, but also the shape of people's skulls and things like this, which we now laugh at as pseudoscience, were developed around this idea that if you can just measure, you can measure someone's brain capacity and thus how likely they are to be an intelligent and or a criminal or what have you. Again, pseudoscience charlatanry at this point, but at that point it was taken very seriously. And from that arose a number of different ways of categorizing people based on physical characteristics. So not just fingerprinting, but of course, ultimately we've seen iris scanning. And now things that sound completely unbelievable, cameras that can identify people by their gait, the way that they walk, or even heartbeat, heart rate monitors that can identify you by your heartbeat pattern, and things that sound absolutely outlandish and probably are, given that some of the types of technology that we've seen employed in criminal forensics over the years has turned out to be more or less charlatanry, like lie detectors, but still continue to be used in courtrooms, and hair analysis and other such things that have been long since debunked, but are still clung to. One could imagine that it will be a similar thing. Well, the computer says that your heartbeat identified you as being in this place or something along those lines. But the idea, I think, is to wrap your biometric identification, generally speaking, fingerprints and iris scans, until they come up with more creative ways, I think, of identifying you, and tie that into a digital identity of some sort. And more that's looking like it will be presented to the public as some sort of health pass that will generally be developed by companies like IBM that have a long and interesting histories with the identifying people and categorizing them electronically. People who are interested in that might like to look into the history of the Hollerith machine and how that was used to categorize and slot people into place during the Nazi atrocities in World War II, with the active complicity of IBM at the time, and how the IBM story interfaces with the Microsoft Bill Gates story. But perhaps that's a whole other aspect of this. But anyway, all of this is to be merged into a sort of biometric digital identity, which Klaus Schwab says we are going to merge our biological, our digital, our physical identity into one thing in the future, and we're going to upload our consciousness to the mainframe computers and what have you. It sounds absolutely outlandish until you read it in the words of this chairman of the World Economic Forum and where they're planning on taking it from here. But ultimately, I think this is the nightmare society in which people can essentially be not just limited from going to a concert or a sporting event or something based on some vaccine, lack of vaccine or some positive test result or what have you, but literally, eventually, when this is merged with the digital central bank currencies, which are about to be unleashed on the public, that are already being trialed by China and Russia, and that are coming soon to a country near you, when these digital central bank currencies are ultimately issued, I have no doubt they will eventually, whether that's in a question of years or decades, but they will eventually be merged into this biometric identification that will be coupled with your vaccine passport and what have you, so that eventually you will be able, the government will be able to shut off a person from accessing even the monetary system itself. Even buying and selling will be essentially a switch that can be flipped off if somebody doesn't do what the government is telling them to do. And this of course is the ultimate nightmare science fiction society dystopia that we've seen in a million different science fiction dystopian novels and or movies. And when it's presented at that end stage, at that last part of what that vision looks like, of course, people can still, I think, recognize that as being a nightmare. But when it's step by step and by step, and it seems quite logical, well, of course we need a vaccine passport of some sort, and of course we need a biometric identity so that we can make sure that it's that person with their fingerprint and their iris scan or whatever. And of course we need the government to come in and help all these business people who've been put out of work with some sort of universal basic income. And well, of course they can't just give money to everyone. You have to, obviously, you have to be vaccinated and whatever else in order to receive your income. And of course, if you don't do that, well, then the government should shut you off. Eventually, people can be led along to the very dystopia that they would recoil at if it was presented to them all at once.
Absolutely. And if you suckle the masses long enough on convenience and safety, then, you know, it becomes more, they want more of that, of course. They want the next step of that, especially when there's some looming threat, such as COVID. So they're more than willing to trade their autonomy and their freedom to continue along in their little bubble of convenience and, you know, having all of the comforts of life that they've come accustomed to. But this is really the antithesis.
I think so. And let me just interject by saying that one of the important things to understand about that is that, of course, this level of technological tyranny that's coming into view right now is really only enabled by the technology that we have today. So it would not have been technologically possible in previous eras. But if you were to somehow magically transport people from the 18th century into today with the technology that exists, I think they would be utterly horrified at the dependence of so much of the population on government and on societal structures to provide the basic means of subsistence. I mean, this was an important part of the ethos of people like Thomas Jefferson and others writing in the 18th century about the yeoman farmer being the basis of human freedom. We need people who, if not completely self-sufficient, but are at least capable of providing some of the most basic essentials for themselves and their family and trading with others in their communities. That was always understood as being essential to human liberty. So what does it mean that that has been so thoroughly taken out of the human equation altogether?
Yeah. And it's hard to wrap your mind around it if you see it as being purely motivated by money. I mean, this seems to go beyond that because most of the people that are orchestrating this, I mean, they're probably at a level where money is not even something that they have to worry about anymore. It seems to be more something of a transhumanist agenda, so more about control.
I certainly think so. I think there is a monetary element to this, and that explains the motivation for a lot of people at the lower levels of this agenda, the people who are motivated at still on the monetary level. But I think, yes, I think demonstrably so, that the people at the very top of this system who are directing this are either the multi-billionaires for whom a few extra million here and there means absolutely nothing, or the people who are literally creating the money out of nothing through the central banking fraud. And that truly is about power more so than about money. What does money mean when it is literally created out of nothing by the banks? If you're a banker, it doesn't mean zeros in a bank account doesn't necessarily mean anything other than points in a game. And the game is for power and control. And if you can sacrifice some of those points in order to gain more control, there are many people who would make that calculus and decide that the control is much more valuable to them than the zeros in their bank account. So I think you're right. I think we have to understand this agenda as at a much deeper level than simply about money. Although it's a good way of at least people who are completely new to this to get their mind wrapped around it. And one thing that I like to point out is it is the very type of people who in 99% of other circumstances would be very vocally opposed to any sort of whiff of any sort of corporation coming along to try to solve a problem. No, we need government to do it because only government is motivated by angels and corporations are, of course, motivated by profit and greed, are the very same people who absolutely 100% immediately reject any questioning of, for example, the big pharma corporations and their role in all of this. How could you possibly malign their pure motives? I mean, these are just saints descended from heaven to take care of the human population, and they have no motivation other than that. The greed couldn't possibly affect one of these big pharma corporations. I just find that to be a particularly interesting point of confusion or hypocrisy on the part of a lot of people who are pushing this narrative, and one that might be fruitful for people in their lives to explore if they have people who are pushing back against them for daring to question the big pharma companies.
Interesting is a very, very polite way of putting it. Absolutely.
I'm speaking diplomatically, of course.
Yeah, of course. You're great at that. And of course, you know, relying on people having smartphones to have these apps on them or, you know, carrying a card around or something like that, all of that is too subject to, you know, you could just not have a phone. You could just not have the card. So logically, we are going to try, or they are going to try, to get people to wear this stuff on their body, wearables. And that's where quantum dot tags come in, right?
That is certainly one of the implications of this, and something that I've been warning about a long time in a specific context, namely the idea of search, which is something that has really affected me over the past several years, as I've found, for example, YouTube, which is the second largest search engine in the world, interestingly enough, Google, of course, being the first, but the second largest search engine by use is YouTube. People go to YouTube and try to search for a specific topic. Oh, right. It makes sense. There's a lot of videos that people want to see on a lot of different topics. So people go there and they type something into search. And previously to 2018, I believe, if people typed, for example, Federal Reserve into the YouTube search engine, my documentary on the Federal Reserve was the number one result. And it was that way for at least a few years between its release in 2014 and 2018. It had enjoyed a place of prominence in those search results. But when MSNBC's Chris Hayes tweeted out a warning, oh, if you type Federal Reserve into YouTube, you're going to see this. And he posts a screenshot of my documentary and says, oh, this toxic algorithm needs to be changed. Well, wouldn't you know it, literally the very next day when you went to YouTube and typed in Federal Reserve, you didn't get my documentary. In fact, you didn't get it anywhere in the top search results. You didn't get it at all. You have to scroll through page after page after page to find someone who had mirrored my documentary, but you wouldn't find it on my page, even if you searched by the title, which was an interesting turn of events and showed that obviously search is important. And I think the people who are trying to control information understand that. One of the implications of that, one of the reasons I think for scrubbing search results for certain generic terms like Federal Reserve is because in the future, I mean, right now we're used to actually controlling our devices to some extent, and you make a search and you see the search results and you don't like them, so you refine your search results, etc. But in the future, the devices that we have are not going to be with that type of control in mind. They are going to be hearables and wearables and things that we, like Alexa or whatever, it's in the room, but you don't really do anything. You just say, hey, Alexa, tell me about the Federal Reserve, and it will give you probably most likely a Wikipedia result or something along those lines. Anyway, a fact checker approved result. And there's not much you can do with that. You can't refine the search results or go through it. I mean, you can keep asking Alexa for more information or what have you, but that's a lot of work. Most people are not going to do that. So the form that these devices take are going to start to shape the information that we have, the type of information that we have access to, the way that we interact with that information, and ultimately shape our minds and thus our behavior as a result of that. And yes, I mean, one of the other ways in which this plays out is that, for example, with quantum dot tattoos, as people may or may not know, this is technology that has been developed at the behest of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the past few years, where the idea is that along with your vaccine, which will be delivered by a little patch, it's not going to be a needle they stick in you, you'll just put a little patch on your arm, and part of that will be a quantum dot dye that will be embedded in your skin and that will be scannable by a smartphone so that someone will be able to wave a smartphone and see that you have received the vaccine or not received the vaccine. It's a way that's embedded in your body and thus a lot harder to fake than a vaccine passport or what have you. And the implications of that, again, are, I think, quite nightmarish because, again, people are literally being tagged essentially in that system. Obviously, that isn't being done yet, or at least not officially, they've already talked about their intentions to do that in the future so that we won't have to have these cumbersome vaccine passport things. We'll just be able to wave our scanners over you and tell whether or not you are part of the cattle, essentially the human cattle.
Yeah. So a lot of this agenda of control is about getting choke points, covering all the choke points. And of course, we've talked, one of those is finances. So all cash turning into digital cash. Another one of those choke points would be food. And there's been talk of it as sort of an orchestrated food shortage. And then you hear about Bill Gates purchasing 240,000 acres of farmland. What do you think? I mean, do you think that that's something that's actually happening?
Choke points are an extremely important way of understanding what's happening. And I think looking back in the 2030s, when we look back at the 2020s, I predict that a couple of the most important trends that we will see having taken place out of all of this biosecurity nonsense that's going on right now, the changeover to central bank digital currencies will be a fundamentally transformative event, and the change of the food supply, the engineering of the food supply will be an incredibly important event looking backwards, I predict. And precisely for the reasons that you mentioned, because, I mean, I think it should be quite obvious that one's access to the basic financial system is the basis, essentially, of flourishing of life or languishing in death, essentially, in our current society. The way that it's been engineered and the fact that people are pretty much dependent on these fiat currencies makes them very much vulnerable in that respect. And also, as we talked about earlier, as people get more and more disconnected from being able to supply their own essentials, like, for example, growing at the very least a garden or raising livestock in the backyard or what have you, as people get more and more disconnected from that, they are more and more reliant on big factory farming operations to provide their meals for them. And Gates is not only buying farmland, he's also heavily investing in these synthetic meats and synthetic meat products and proteins that are coming on, that are the technology is being worked on right now and is increasingly finding its way into Impossible Burgers and what have you. What I think the public may not understand is that this is really the culmination of a century-long, if not longer, quest to ultimately monopolize the food supply itself. Once food is not a thing that grows in the ground or naturally is wandering around in the fields, but is some synthetic thing that is produced in a laboratory by a corporation, then once we have essentially engineered natural food, if not completely out of the food supply, at least largely out of the food supply, then we have put ourselves even further in the hands of these corporations that must be relied upon to provide our daily necessities. That should be nightmarish, again, to anyone who has their head screwed on straight and is understanding and worried about the trends that are taking shape in terms of consolidation of control in fewer and fewer hands. That's where all of this keeps going back to, the consolidation of monetary control in the central bank's hands, the consolidation of food supply in the hands of a few corporations, It keeps going back to towards that centralization of power in fewer and fewer hands. And ultimately, this does lead to a, at the very best, an oligopoly situation where there's a few cronies essentially that control everything, or ultimately even a monopoly is where this ultimately leads towards. And again, I think the very types of people who would tend to at least give lip service to, well, we can't have monopolies, that's why the government has to come in and take over this or that sector of the economy so that to prevent the corporations from forming a monopoly, seem to be the ones who are cheering on people like Gates as they're starting to consolidate control over the food supply, for example.
Exactly. And speaking of main characters, I mean, Bill Gates probably seems to be the most recurring name in all of this. I mean, it seems like all roads, or at least the major roads, lead to Bill Gates. What is his role in all of this?
He's clearly a funding mechanism for a lot of these technologies and ideas. And I think someone who believes himself to be an important thinker who is making a lot of this happen. I don't believe that's necessarily the case. And I do examine that to a certain extent in my biography of Bill Gates, Who is Bill Gates, that I released last year, that you can't find on YouTube anymore since they scrubbed my channel, but you can find at corbettreport.com/Gates, a 2-hour exploration specifically of Gates and public health, although I really could make another documentary or two or three on some of the other things that he's involved in, like the food supply, like solar engineering, geoengineering, experiments, essentially, like all sorts of other things that he's involved with. But one of the things that I examined was his real origin story and how IBM came to be knocking on the door of this pimply-faced teenager eating pizza and living off of Coke in Albuquerque. Why did they come to him, and how did that really happen? And is it just, you know, is the story as we've been told the whole story, or does it have something to do with his mother sitting on the board of the United Way with IBM executive? And you know, what was the real story there? I think essentially Gates is just a convenient cutout for powers that are probably above him. But at any rate, he is certainly on board with this agenda and funding seemingly every aspect of it. And as I say, it's hard to think of anything major that's happening in the world today that isn't doesn't have some Gates funding or influence somewhere. And one a perfect example of that, where this all seems to come together, was something that I highlighted in that Gates documentary. Gates's work in India over the past several years, again, seemingly at every step of this, involved, of course, in the mass vaccination drives and being heavily involved with the office, the supposedly independent office that was advising and ultimately steering the Indian government's decisions on mass inoculation campaigns, to the creation of the digital identity in the Aadhaar system, the largest biometric database in the world with over 1 billion Indians' fingerprints and iris scans, and how that connects into the digital currency and his approval of Indian Prime Minister Modi's demonetization scheme, and how he was there and involved and advising the Indian government every stage of the way. All of these agendas seem to come together in stories like that, and they all have Gates funding and involvement in them. It's, again, it's very interesting to see some of these players and how they connect to these various agendas.
Absolutely. And this is just strictly my opinion, but I feel that he's one of the most uncharismatic human beings alive today.
Again, I think that's a diplomatic way of putting it. Yeah, I agree. In fact, it is almost, if you step back at it, if it wasn't so horrifying, it would be laughable. I mean, truly laughable to put this man up as some sort of spokesman for this agenda and this idea. I can't for the life of me imagine sitting there watching one of his crazy, hand-wavy, giggly interviews and thinking that this is someone that I think should be in charge of global public health, despite the fact that he's, a software engineer, essentially a businessman from the 90s. How did he become this public health spokesman? Why are we turning to him to tell us what should be happening during this global pandemic that we're being told we're living through? It makes no sense on any level other than the monetary one, in which if you have billions to throw around, you can buy yourself any amount of media coverage you want.
It's like the keep the kid in the picture kind of dynamic. Like, well, Jesus Christ, he has the fucking money, so we might as well, put him in front of the camera and let him talk about it.
Yeah, Strangely enough, I think a lot of people actually seem to have swallowed it. I think they've swallowed a lot of their own propaganda, that to the extent that some of these news readers, Mockingbird repeaters on television, I think genuinely do believe, without thinking about it or thinking about it too deeply, well, Gates seems to be sort of an expert on this. I'm glad we have his opinion on it.
Absolutely insane. Well, I know we don't have a whole lot more time, and I don't want to leave people dangling in the darkness like this. So I know that there are things that we can do, or at least focus on doing, to try and curtail this. And one of those is counter-economics. Would you explain briefly what that is and how we can utilize it to battle against this?
So counter-economic activity, counter-economics, is anything that is being done without the sanction of the state. And that could be literally anything from driving, I don't know if you're American or where you are, but I'll convert this into American speak. 31 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone? I don't know if that makes sense. Anyway, driving a mile an hour over the limit could be seen as counter-economic activity. It is prescribed by the state. You can't do it, but you do that, and that is your carving out that space for freedom. More interestingly, more dangerously, more excitingly, maybe gun running or something like that, of course, black market activity. But anything and everything that is not sanctioned by the state, it could literally just be someone who doesn't have a license to perform haircuts in their particular state that are doing it out of their living room for cash under the table, again, is counter-economic activity. And the idea here is that ultimately the gray and black markets, if they could ever actually be added up, probably amount to a greater economy than the above board economy, and really do supply a lot of people with their livelihood, or at least with some extra income. And if people started to use that strategically and consciously as a way of undermining the state and realizing that the state is in fact the monopolizing, centralizing entity that gets in the way of transactions between free and voluntary human activity, then we could have a transformative effect in using counter-economic activity to actually undermine the state and to deliberately make the choice to engage in more counter-activity, working for cash under the table, for example, to the extent that as continue to have avenues like cash at our disposal. And that was kind of the point when this philosophy, this idea of agorism was developed by Samuel Konkin back a few decades ago, and he was writing about counter-economics and agorism as the practice and philosophy of using counter-economics to undermine the state and to increase the sphere of voluntary human activity. The vision was really to grow the gray and black markets, to grow the markets outside of the state's purview, to the point where you don't need some sort of violent revolution to overthrow the state. In fact, that generally gives the state more life insofar as they have, oh, look at those evil people that are coming to overthrow us. You citizens who love law and order, you can see that. So now we have to respond with violence. And of course, the state will generally win that game. But if you can undermine them by completely cutting their legs out, economically speaking, and making them irrelevant, then you can undermine them on a more fundamental level. And an example of that would be something like the taxicab monopolies that were granted in under the old system, whereby in New York, you'd have to pay $1 million for your taxicab medallion or whatever to be able to run a taxicab. And along comes something like Uber or Lyft. And suddenly that entire paradigm gets thrown on its head. And people wonder, why did I ever have to call and wait for some cab to come pick me up? No, I got this app, I can do this. That's the idea of this type of thing that comes along and completely subverts the system. And I think that's the idea of using counter-economics. Now, obviously, there's a million different things to consider there. And that is something that I have been considering for many years, and I'm more explicitly so and on a more thoroughgoing basis exploring in my work now, because after 14 years of doing this type of work, I'm personally quite sick of just documenting what is being done to us and much more interested in what we can actually do. So I hope people who are interested will check out my Solutions Watch series, where I'm talking about various aspects of what people can do to take more of their lives in their own hands and actually make a difference creating some space for human freedom while we still have the ability to do so. Because unfortunately, as we've been talking about today, the Great Reset is coming and it doesn't want to leave anybody behind. So I think we have to be creating the alternative structures that will see us through that sort of disruptive event before it comes and takes us all out, so to speak.
I love it. I love it. I'm totally behind that. Do you think that we'll see, or are we seeing an increase in intentional communities? And do you think that that will ever lead to something as drastic as, for instance, here in the States, states seceding from the union?
I, at the very least, can point to one very observable metric to prove that people are at least more interested in the intention of intentional communities, specifically Freedom Cells, which is a site that I've talked about a few times, that offers a way for people to essentially connect in their geographical area with other like-minded people towards the idea of creating cells of people who will be able to essentially help each other out in various ways or share information or what have you. Interest in that has absolutely exploded over the course of this pandemic scenario. I think going from a couple of thousand users to over 20,000 at this point. People are very, very thirsty for this type of real community with people who actually share some of their ideas and ideals. So I think that is happening. How that will eventuate, what will that look like? Will we be able to carve out geographical territories where this sort of freedom is more respected, and where and when and how will that happen? Obviously, all very, very still much in the air and on the table. But at any rate, it is happening. And I can see, I mean, we can point to metrics like that. People are more and more interested in this idea, which, again, just a couple of years ago seemed, crazy. Why do I need that? Why would I need to find people in my area? Well, now people understand why it is so incredibly important to find like-minded people who are questioning the narrative. And I don't know how this will turn out, but I know that if we don't act on this now, then it will turn out into the Great Reset nightmare that the Great Reset planners have in mind for us. So we have to use this moment of opportunity to try to form intentional communities and try to erect a different structure than the structure of control they're trying to bring in.
I wholeheartedly agree. I applaud that. And I also thank you so much for your work and for taking the time to speak with us today. And you're just very thoroughly researched, and you really put a lot of time and effort and energy and love into what you do, which is spreading such usable and fantastic knowledge. I really applaud what you've done for the last, 18 years, 15 years?
14.
14 years. Okay.
Yeah, just 14. I'm a baby, really.
But you've got quite a legacy behind you, and I appreciate that very much. Would you mind telling the listeners where they can find you and your work online?
Well, the best place to find me is at my website, CorbettReport.com. And that's where you can find all of my work. It's all backed up there, and you can even stream my videos and or audio directly from my servers there. I do post to various social media and alternative video platforms like BitChute, like Minds.com, like Odyssey. But the best place to find the work is CorbettReport.com. And while you're there, I'll invite people who are interested to scroll down the sidebar a little and click on the IPFS button, and they will find an IPFS mirror of my website where with all the MP3 and MP4 files, the actual audio and video files backed up to IPFS. If you don't know what IPFS is, well, this might be a good opportunity for you to learn a little bit about it. The Interplanetary File System, which is essentially a peer-to-peer network that there is no central server. It cannot be removed. So that information will be up there for as long as there are people hosting that information anywhere in the world. And so I think that's an important step going further. And more, even more importantly, it can't be censored by blocking a domain name, which we haven't seen used so much yet. It has been used, but not so much in terms of censorship, but it will be used increasingly in the future. So when and if you can't access something like a CorbettReport.com, you will be able to access it through IPFS. So I think it's important for us to start thinking about these sort of longer term and more infrastructural ways of preserving work. Anyway, long story short, go to CorbettReport.com first. And just dip into the archives. There's 14 years of archives. I put everything up for free, so I hope people will use it as a resource.
Fantastic. And they can contribute to your cause if they should desire to, right?
Yes, but I only really recommend that if you are a regular listener or you were already. It's only for supporting my work because, again, you're not going to get any special secret access to any secret information by becoming a member.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks so much, James. And I love the anarchic nature of all of this. And I'm hoping for the best. I think as long as there's people like you out there and your listeners and the people that hopefully I'm reaching with this too, we've got a fighting chance.
Well, we will do more than hope. We'll plan and we'll try to bring something to reality. And even if it doesn't work, we'll go down fighting.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, James.
Thank you for having me on.
If you like what you've heard and would like to contribute to The Melt, there are a few ways that you can do so. The most tangible way would be financially by clicking the Patreon link in the episode notes, and there you will find a multitude of ways that you can help for as little as $1 a month. This helps to keep making The Melt better, pay the bills, and help to make this podcast my full-time job that I can fully devote my time to and give you more content. Another way of helping would be by going to wherever it is that you subscribe to The Melt and give it a favorable review or rating that will help to get it out to more people. And lastly, if neither of those options are readily available, simply send your good thoughts and intentions. In an interconnected and quantumly entangled multiverse, these also go a long way. Thank you.